Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 357, recorded July 20th, 2018, for airing July 27th, 2018, Adam Fisher, Valley of Genius, Part 2. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hey, we're really, something happened funny back in the Triangulation Labs. You may have seen our interview with Adam Fisher. He's the author of this book, Valley of Genius. And Adam's got so many great stories about the early days and the present, frankly, of Silicon Valley. I thought maybe we should do a second episode. And we have even more about the history of Silicon Valley. Adam Fisher's stuck around, and I'm glad because there's a lot more to talk about, and we've got to get everybody to buy this book so you can unmortgage your home.
That's true, actually, and it's not a lie.
Buy this book. The lines, operators are standing by. The lines are open. You can buy it on Amazon. You can listen to it on audible.com. And I think you said it just right earlier that there is a whoa on every page. That's how good this book is. We were going through the list of people, and it's in the back of the book of the people you interviewed. How many people did you interview for this?
200 and change. And for hours at a time.
How did you pick them?
Well, I picked the kind of magic moments, you know, the foundings of all the companies you would expect, and then some more that you might not expect, General Magic, maybe Napster, and then some, you know, non-company moments like the first hackers conference or, you know, the SRL kind of debacle where they almost brought down the freeway in San Francisco. And I worked backwards from there.
You even have tweets from the president in here.
Yes. I quote Donald Trump. I do at the end of the Twitter chapter.
Yeah. And you also quote, and I love it, Nick Bilton, who, of course, we know and love, and he's now at Vanity Fair, and he wrote the book on Twitter, the amazing book on Twitter, which you give him good credit for.
Yeah.
He says, I think we'll look back at Twitter in 10, 20, 30 years in the same way we look back at the well today. We talked about the well in our first episode and say, well, that didn't work out so well, did it? Oh, my God. So much fun. And did you go to Paris to talk to Tony or how did
you?
Yeah. You did.
They flew me to Paris to do.
Holy cow.
You didn't read the story.
No.
You got to read that Wired story. He wanted someone to do a story saying, well, what's Tony's point of view, right? So Tony, I had interviewed him a couple times for this book, and his PR person was like, you should do the story because you understand the real Tony. Because Tony, you know, invented the iPod and was instrumental in the iPhone.
He's great in that General Magic documentary because he was just a kid from Michigan who said, I've got to work with Andy and Bill. I got to. And he harassed them.
Right.
Until they finally hired him.
Exactly.
Amazing
guy. That story is in the book.
Yeah, it's an
amazing
story.
So anyway, then I convinced Wired to let me do a profile of Tony. And I followed him around Paris.
Interesting.
And I, you know, he was...
He's doing what all these guys do after they make their money. He's just kind of helping people, right?
He is a rock star. Like, this whole idea that this is a new culture and these are the new rock stars... Tony Fadell is a rock star. I watched people like pitch him stories in the men's room while he was urinating. Okay, what is it? I don't want to invest. And then into the back of the black car. And so I had a week of this.
You followed him for a week.
Yeah, and which culminated
it's
when
like
he,
a Playboy interview, dude.
It was.
Yeah,
and then it culminated in this thing where he's like, I got to talk at this conference, the you know, the Paris, whatever, TechCrunch, basically. And so he's like, let's get on my electric bicycles. Because this is a company he's invested in. And he had these electric bicycles. And we're going.
Is this Lil Webb? Because it's way the hell out of Paris.
I just followed him.
To hell and back. Yeah.
And the bike is connected to his phone, and so he could map it. But there's like a bug in the software of his iPhone, which is sucking his battery drive. So he takes my Android, and then we're like through the streets, like blowing through lights and cutting off traffic. Like, he is a crazy man. I'm just trying to keep up. And we're basically on motorcycles. These are electric
bicycles. Crazy a bicycle in Paris. Okay? That's insane.
And then he's like, is it there? And I'm like, that's it. And he goes, he stops his bike and crashes on the curb. I practically go right over him. And I'm like, oh, we stop. And then he's like, oh, no, I have to be on stage. My white pants are dirty. And I'm like, I grab, he had basically lost my phone. And it just,
went flying.
I pick it up and it's like cracked.
Oh.
And he goes, don't worry, I'm gonna buy you a new phone. This is all in the article. And I'm like, Tony Fadell, the co-inventor of the iPhone, is buying me
an Android,
a Google Android.
Ooh.
I was just like, great. That was a great moment.
Did he?
And he did.
All right. Because that's really what I expected. And then I never heard from him again.
He's not in here.
That's in the. But I have to read the Wired article.
A Wired article. But all of the stuff. All the quotes that I got from him, and they're insane quotes, are in there.
So what's your sense of him then? So because I maybe believe the Google PR.
I don't know who's right there. I will tell you.
The guy they replaced him with just got fired, so I don't know.
Yeah,
there may be other issues.
You know when it comes between choosing the word of an individual who you can look into their eye and then a big corporation with an agenda.
Yeah.
Like I'm just that kind of guy who wants to believe Tony.
Right.
But Tony, you'll see when you read these stories, he's the best person ever to hang out with.
Really,
he's so much fun. But he probably would be the worst person ever to have as your boss.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know. But
he inspired people. And I think the reason that the guy they put in charge had to leave is because the people wanted Tony back.
Yeah.
I mean, his team loved Tony Fadell.
And Tony learned all this craziness from Steve Jobs.
Right.
I mean, it's all literally like, it's as if. You know, it's a
did a lot of people talk about Steve? Did you get
my
favorite? Ed Catmull and
my favorite chapter is the chapter. It's the second to the last chapter. It's the Steve Jobs on his deathbed. Steve Jobs going into the ground. You're at his gravesite, and at Steve Jobs Memorial. And basically every person I interviewed, I said, did you go to the memorial? Were you at the funeral? And what are all the stories? And the whole book is this build up to this crescendo about, you know, Steve Jobs, and then they all weigh in at the end. And Woz is sitting there saying, like,
he didn't have to be a bad person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Larry Brilliant is telling his best Steve Jobs story, and this Mike Slade has his best Steve Jobs story. Because this is not a book about Steve Jobs, right? This is not Walter's book. This is a book about how really Silicon Valley is a network, and there's lots of important people, and Steve Jobs is just one of them that kind of the popular press has fixated on. But he's not the king of Silicon Valley.
No,
he's not like Trump or Bloomberg. He's like just the guy who is the best at manipulating his image. And so he's like this character who kind of crops up every few chapters and kind of messes things up. First is with the Macintosh.
I didn't realize he was an Ayn Rand fanatic.
That's what Waugh says.
I've never heard that one.
And so he, you know, you first see him in at Atari and then at Apple, and then he's like messing things up at Pixar, and then, you know, and then he comes back and he's with the iPod and the modern Apple. And so he's like a recurring theme. But then at the end, you know, everybody in the book gathers essentially at the funeral and talks about what he really what he meant.
Wow.
Did he change? What really motivated him? And we find out that some of these people who knew him best think that to die, he took a massive dose of LSD.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
You got it, buddy.
That's what I always said. Yeah. That's exactly what you say when you're peeking.
Yeah.
You interviewed John Couch.
I did for a long time.
Nice. See, there's a guy I think people don't really know about, but I think he had a lot of, I'm sure he had a lot of, I didn't realize he was at the demo. This is really, really great. Really, really great. Did you interview Draper?
Oh my God, I flew to Vegas to interview Captain Crunch.
Oh man.
The one guy who's poor in this thing.
He is
literally impoverished.
Yeah, it's very sad. He had to raise money for his surgery and
very sad.
He wrote Electric Pencil in jail. He wrote it in force, and he wrote it by hand on paper. And then he'd have work furlough, and he'd go see if it ran, and then he'd come back and write more on paper.
Yeah.
A friend of mine and I were hanging out with him. I don't remember if Waz was there. I don't think so. And he said, let's go wrestle. And now I'm very glad I said no at the time. I was just puzzled. I said, no, I don't think so.
I asked him straight out, hey, are you gay? Are you gay?
He's gay.
And
he never admitted it.
He wouldn't admit it. But every person who knew him says, "Oh, well, you got to know."
He wants to wrestle. He always wants to wrestle.
He's super gay.
Yeah.
So.
Well, but that's sad. I mean, that's a tragedy because he's from an era where you can't talk. He really is a tragic figure.
He is a broken man.
Some of it is
tragic.
On his own making.
Well, yes.
Maybe all of it.
I think maybe all of it.
I remember he was so against smoking. He would go ballistic. If he smelled cigarette smoke, he would go, like, bat crazy. It was like, oh, okay.
I went out to dinner with him in Vegas. He went bat crazy that they didn't seat him within 30 seconds of getting to the restaurant.
So that's what I'm saying. It was a little bit of his own making.
A
wonderful guy. You loved the guy. Waz loved him.
It was Waz's hero.
Yeah.
And the guy who showed, you know, who inspired Waz to make the Blue Box?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Blue Box. So Waz made the first digital Blue Box. And what I have from Draper is it didn't work very well because it was digital, not like my beautiful analog design.
Analog.
And it got people in jail all the time. He accuses Waz of like putting people.
Because Jobs and Waz went around in colleges and they would sell these boxes to college kids so they could make long distance calls back home.
And then they got held
and
they
got
up.
Arrested.
They got held up at gunpoint.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. That story's in there. And then they're like, maybe not. And then the next time Waz made something interesting was the Apple One. And Jobs kind of came sniffing around and smelled money and was like, I can make a business out of this. And
that was his line.
You know,
Waz says that every time I do something, Jobs would say, I can make a business out of that. You know what? Waz was kind of sort of turning. You're right. Come to think of it. I didn't realize he didn't go to the memorial. Was that the Apple campus memorial or there was
the private
memorial?
The one at Stanford. So there are three. There was the private funeral with like a dozen people there. That is reported out. You are there and in this book with the people talking about what happened there. That was intense.
Yeah.
And then there was the Stanford memorial, which was like, you know, heads of state, celebrities and all the movers and shakers in the Valley, and you are there. That actually has never been reported out in a story anywhere, so that's the first time you can read about it. And then there's the Apple Campus thing, which I didn't bother to do
because it was saw that. We all watched.
We all watched it.
I spent a weekend with Jobs and Loreen and Lisa.
Really?
In 93 or 94, he wasn't at Apple. He was at Next. But he was we were at a we're up in what was called Wintoon, which is the Hearst Corporation retreat up in McLeod, up in Northern California. It was Jobs, Jerry Harrison from The Talking Dead. It was a bunch of people, and Will Hearst put it together. And we had just had our daughter Abby. She was like a year and a half. That's how I know the date. It was a 4th of July weekend, and Reed had just been born. Steve's kid had just been born. Oh. I remember reading, like, Dr. Seuss to Reed, and it was really cute, and playing volleyball with Steve. But even then, even though he wasn't an Apple, and he was an arrogant son of a gun. He was.
All his best archival interviews are from that time.
Yeah.
Because he was a little more accessible, and he would actually say things.
He was outspoken.
Yeah.
I remember him saying, we had a 10-year lead on Microsoft. And we blew it. He said, when Windows 3.1 came out, it was over. Apple should have won that one, but 95 or whatever it was, it would be 94. We blew it. He was really outspoken, but he was bitter, Steve. I always take it, he's a little bitter. He just got fired. Mm-hmm. But, he was very interesting. He was
a
character.
Fascinating character.
Yeah. Yeah. And I loved Loreen. She was a sweetheart. And it was interesting that they were all together with Lisa, which was very interesting.
Must have been hard for her. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think it was. No? I think Loreen is pretty enlightened. She's a high spirit. I don't know what she's like now, but, and I think they were all trying to be a family.
Well, what do you think about Steve's journey? I mean, it's just a documented fact that he was kind of
idea that he committed suicide with a massive dose of LSD.
Well, you can't actually...
Who said that?
I can't. That's an off the record one. But then I went.
It kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, he was on death's door.
He chose to die. So he
that
knew
makes
the
sense.
Time of his death. You can't actually kill yourself with LSD
as
a hippie.
Go,
you know that. But if you know you're going,
what a great way to go.
Yeah, and that's he knew that that's what Huxley did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's how Huxley went, and that Doors of Perception.
So if you know you're going to die, you just go, well, it's not going to kill you, but maybe that'll just be the door, and you'll walk through
it. Beyond. And I think he became very spiritual at the end.
Yeah.
Returned to that kind of the...
What else are you going to do? You're facing death.
I mean, this is a normal
Nothing
thing.
Nothing matters.
Right?
All that stuff you did doesn't matter anymore.
Exactly. So he returned to that kind of... enlightenment trip that he was on as a young man at the very end. And so that arc is very clearly drawn in this book.
I love the stories about Barefoot Steve.
Yeah.
That was really great.
And it all comes back at the end because there he is again, just like a 19-year-old, guru. And the question really that I asked everybody, including Brilliant, is like, do you think that he, was enlightened? Did you really think, because Brilliant and all his contemporaries, and he counts Steve among them, believes that Neem Karoli Baba, the guru that Ram Dass wrote about, was not just enlightened, but had a Jesus Christ-like powers, like could read your mind, maybe could do some simple teleportation. Yeah. Like they believed that this guy was the godchild.
Right.
And the way Brilliant tells the story is that Steve believed too. Mm. And, the first guy that Steve called after he got that diagnosis that he was going to die was Brilliant. And he said, do you believe? Do you believe? And Brilliant said, yeah, I believe in Neem Karoli Baba. Like, it's happening. And so Steve went right back to to being 19 in that spiritual journey. Yeah. And when they put him in the ground, planted him in the grave with just like a dozen of the closest friends, including Brilliant. Brilliant was reading from the Bhagavad Gita over the grave.
Wow.
Okay? Like, that's the story. Those are stories in there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then there is a speculation, you know, did he choose to die on acid? And, you know,
If he could have gotten the acid.
I'm sure he could get anything he wants, you know.
The problem is it's hard to make, and the acid these days is not the acid of our
that's
era.
That's what they say. No more window
pane. No more window pane. Man, that window pane was good stuff. But I bet you Steve knew somebody who could make it.
I bet he knew somebody who knew somebody. Yeah. You know, I mean, come
pharmaceutical.
On.
Pharmaceutical. Interesting. Yeah, you know what? I never thought about that, but that is exactly what I would do.
You and
that's
me both,
really interesting.
Leo.
No, because you do. I mean, yeah. Whether you're going somewhere or not, you kind of want to at least keep the hope alive. The quotes in here are from the funeral. I'm just looking at these are really good. And it does show that there was something about Steve that really did something to people. There was something magical.
Yeah,
there.
I never got to meet the guy, but it's clear that...
I didn't see any of the magic. Although I played volleyball with him, and he hated me because I wasn't very good. He was very competitive. He said, come on! I was on his team. Come on, Leo! Get your head in the game! So I've been yelled at by Steve, too. So there you go. I would have, you know, had I thought about it, I would have tried to talk to him about that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if he would have been open to that or not, you know. Very good. Very, very, very good stuff. The Endless Frontier is fun, too, because it's, I should have mentioned that, but just what people think is going to happen is very interesting.
Scott Hassan is just...
What does he say?
Oh, we're going to Mars tomorrow, and wouldn't it be, I mean, can you imagine that Mars as a real estate play?
He's like, nuts.
You could pre-sell all of it, you know.
Do you know how hard it's going to be to live on Mars?
Well, I wasn't, you know, I'm just writing it down. I'm just rolling tape. I'm just documenting what these guys
You have
think.
No opinion on this?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I do think Scott Hassan and others are right that we're just at the very beginning of something.
Oh, yes. AI
you know,
is
this
is going to be very interesting.
You know, I think we're going to look back on this era and say, oh, what was everybody all worked up about? You know, like tweets, you know?
Right. That's not it.
Like, you know, they couldn't figure out how to deal with, like, bullies.
I want to be at this cocktail party with Kevin Kelly, Scott Hassan, Nolan Bushnell, Wozniak, Jim Clark. That's and Jaron Lanier. I want to be at that cocktail party.
Yeah, so that's...
Man.
All the...
Man. Tiffany Schlain is interesting that you interviewed her.
Well, I do think if we're looking at it as a cultural story, she's very important.
She's been watching the whole thing.
Well, she was the kind of poster woman for the web. They flew her out every week to be on Good Morning America to explain what the web was about to like, you know, whoever was watching.
Right.
And she had the big party of that era, the Webbies. That was her creation.
Right.
And she kind of brought everybody together and again kind of gave it a feeling and an ethos in the same way kind of Stuart Brand did a decade or two before.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, she was a maven. She was a cultural maven.
She was a cultural maven. Yeah. And I think this is a cultural story.
Yeah.
She's off being a filmmaker now.
Her father was really interesting.
Leonard Schlain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing, those books.
I love his stuff. I think he's really interesting. He took a little acid, too. At some point, definitely. Yeah.
You know, Tiffany just got a book contract.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She should have her on.
Yeah, her father was one of the most interesting. Did you interview Moby?
I did.
How cool is that?
Yeah. And he's in the Napster chapter.
I needed
a musician who to tell me, well, what it meant from their point of view. And he was just like, he was very pro-Napster.
I think I've seen the quotes, which must be from this or your Wired stories. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen the quotes, and he liked it.
He liked it.
He thought it was great.
He thought it was the new radio.
Right.
He was.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and he was very supportive. So I want to complicate these narratives that, you know, oh, Napster is all bad and they were trying to take down the music industry. It's not actually true when you go.
It's the real problem with history. I'm glad you didn't, because it tends to be, it solidifies. It gets, you know, it petrifies. Those stories become truth after a while. And it isn't. It's much more nuanced than that. So I'm glad that you did that.
It's much more interesting. Yeah. And in that case, it's like the history was written by the winners, and the winner was Hollywood. Yeah. And they just, you know, it's just not how it happened. Like, the facts are different.
No. No. And I remember there was a guy I worked with. He was like 16. He was wrote game reviews. He was a little kid. He wrote game reviews in the newspaper. He said, all the kids... He was in college by then. All the kids are used to doing this thing called MP3s. It's the latest thing. We've got servers running, and tell me about this MP3 thing. I vividly remember this was like 94, because we were doing the site for MSNBC at the time, and it was, I think I was the first person to tell the world about MP3s.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. We're having fun talking. We're having so much fun talking with Adam, and I want to keep him around a little bit longer. Adam Fisher, our guest, the book Valley of Genius, The Uncensored History of Silicon Valley. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. This is a great time, a grand time to buy a new home. Actually, it's not. It isn't, because interest rates are starting to go up. But I've got a solution for you. You know, buying a house, it's important. It's a big deal. When it comes time to buy a home, and you really should buy a home, it's a wonderful thing to have your own house. You're going to probably get a loan. But here's why it's anxious making. Because as you're looking for the house, the clock is ticking. The rates have been going up. You notice that? And as the clock ticks and the rates go up, you're going every minute, every day, every week that you're looking, that house is going to cost you more. I got a solution. Rocket Mortgage, of course. We've talked about them before. The entirely online mortgage approval process. Quicken Loans created. Dan Gilbert and his team are technologists, first and foremost. They love it, and they really wanted to make an easy way, a modern way for you to apply for a home loan. And now they have this thing they call the power buying process. I love this. This is at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. When you apply for a loan, we've mentioned this before, how it works. You know, they verify your income, assets, and credit. They do it automatically. You don't have to go to the attic to get paperwork or anything. They'll do it fast, less than 24 hours. You will then get verified approval, which is really a great thing to have in hand when you're looking at homes, because from the point of view of the buyer, you're like a cash buyer. The seller looks at you like, well, they're good for it. We don't have to worry. No, there's no contingencies on them getting the loan. They got the money. But the next part is really where the anxiety just floats away. Once you're verified, you qualify for Rocket Mortgage's all new exclusive. They call it Rate Shield Approval. They lock your rate up. They give you 90 days to buy the house. That rate will not go up. Even if rates everywhere else go up, your rate is locked in. You have a 3 whole months to look for a house. If the rates go down, don't worry. They'll lower your rate, but they can't go up. Either way, you win. It's exactly what you expect from the best mortgage lender in the country. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. Go there now. Get it set up. Get ready. That way, when you find that home of your dreams or you start looking seriously in earnest, you'll be ready. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for making this show possible. I'm thrilled because we get a chance to spend some more time with Adam Fisher. His book is out now. You got to read it. If you're at all interested in how we got here, and what happened. And there's some really interesting chapters, in particular the last chapter, where you get many of the people that you talk to in the beginning of the book to talk about what the future is going to be like. That is by itself an eye-opener. You call it the endless frontier. And you mentioned before that you thought Scott Hassan was somebody very... Who is Scott Hassan?
So Scott Hassan is kind of the breakthrough interview for my kind of paleo Google chapter, Google at Stanford, right, before they even incorporated. And he is the unacknowledged or barely acknowledged third founder of Google.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Who ever heard of him? You got Larry, you got Sergey, and you got Scott?
Yes. So what you got are these PhD
this
students.
Poor guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So and he was a doctorate student along
no,
with Larry?
No, he's like a worker.
Oh.
He was just a programmer that the CS department hired to like, get, so that their doctorate students could do like, you know.
A big thinker.
Big thinking. But someone needed to write the code. Someone needed to write
Hassan
the code.
Hassan did the code?
And so Hassan, so the first thing is like, you know, so Paige is like, okay, I got an, you know.
This PageRank. I'm going to call it PageRank.
No, no, no. It was before that. It was so Paige is like, okay, I got a great idea. You know, the internet is interesting because it's going to get me a PhD.
Okay.
I'm going to study the internet and get a PhD. So what do you have to do first? You have to download the internet. So what do? You write a crawler and you start downloading the internet. So Paige wrote it. And it was downloading the internet slower than the internet was expanding.
You couldn't keep up.
It would never
work. It's like
it
painting
would never
the Golden
work.
Gate Bridge.
It never worked. And Scott Hassan, who was like palling around with Sergey, you know, lock picking and breaking into things, looked at this and was just like, this is dope. He can't even code. So as like an exploit, as like a joke, he breaks in to Larry's office and one weekend throws away the browser, the web crawler code, and just trashes it and rewrites the whole thing. And then so when Larry shows up on Monday, like his code, which is now Scott Hassan's code, his crawler is running something like 10,000 times faster.
Oh.
And so the whole interweb gets downloaded, and Larry gets to like, and Sergey get to do some crazy math. And they developed PageRank. And because what they wanted to do was, you know, see what the backlinks were.
Right.
They wanted to surf the web backwards.
That's
and,
right.
And so Hassan explains all this. And then they're like, well, what can we do when we have this, you know, look at the backlinks? And then they're like, oh, we can look, we can see who's pointing at whom, and then we can make that into PageRank. And so they solve this big equation for the entire web, and it ranks everything in order. So if you search for Stanford, it comes up Stanford. Right. And they're like, oh, that'll get us our PhD. And,
that's
and,
all they
and
cared
Scott
about.
And Scott Hassan said, no, we got to make a search engine. They were like, no, no.
Wait a minute.
There's already search engines. That's
there's
not
Alta
research.
Vista, dude. No one needs this.
That's not research, okay?
Right.
That's not research.
You don't get a PhD.
You don't get a PhD.
For a product, you get it for research.
For something Excite and Lycos already did, okay? You get a PhD for new shit.
Oh my
and so,
God.
So Scott Hassan was not even allowed to work on things that weren't research. So he, at night, with Sergey, at night, because it wasn't research, wrote the Google, wrote the software that took PageRank and made it into a search engine. And then they're like, great, we have a search engine.
What are we going to do with it?
What are we going to do with it? Let's license it. Let's
That's
license it.
That's right. They tried
it.
To
they
give
try
it
to,
away.
And they tried to
away.
Give it away.
To
let's
Yahoo.
Run it as a, you know, yeah. thing. Let's sell it. Maybe, you know,
who
like get a job.
This? Yeah.
And Scott just got, and meanwhile, this is the late 90s, mid to late 90s, and the web is popping off, right? It's like everybody's getting rich. And so Scott Hassan says, I can't wait for you guys to make Google Inc. I'm going to go make a bundle. And so he did this little company with Larry Page's brother called eGroups. And he makes like over 20 million
eGroups is great.
In 18 months.
Didn't Google buy eGroups to make a Google Groups? I can't remember
I thought
what happened.
Yahoo brought
Maybe
bought
it was Yahoo.
Yahoo
became Yahoo
bought
Groups.
It.
That's right.
And so anyway, but he went, but as just as a thank you, when Google IPO'd, they gave him 1%, I believe.
1% of Google.
Of the whole company. But he'd already
wow.
made 20 million.
Wow.
They were, you know, and so he, and then now he is, so he went on to – his big thing is like, well, how do we get to Mars faster? He wants to terraform Mars, so we need robots. So he opened this thing called Willow Garage, which made this thing called ROS, which is like Unix for robots, free robot operating system. Then he's like now one of the main investors in Magic Leap.
Oh, is he? Yeah,
yeah, he's like the one of the main money.
He says in this chapter, yeah. I don't try not to predict the future very much. One thing I know for certain, in the future, there are going to be more computers. They're going to be faster. They're going to do more things. They're going to do everything. I don't think anything is safe. Nothing.
Yeah.
And he says, don't compete with a computer on doing something, because if you don't lose today, you'll lose tomorrow. So what are we to do as flesh-filled bags of water?
He was like, Adam, why are you writing a book? I'm like, because that's what I do. He's like, you know, no one's going to have books in 5 years.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? No, we'll all put on these glasses and we'll just read on our hands.
He's a big believer in mixed reality. He says, and I agree with him, VR is not good because it blocks your field of vision.
Yeah, yeah.
You talk about that in the book. You also talk to Paul Buchheit, who I love. He's one of the early Googlers. He's the guy who came up with Don't Be Evil.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Paul's a great guy. He did, he left Google and did Friend Feed, which I miss and love. Napster. There's a whole chapter called I'm CEO, Bitch.
That right. is a real business card.
That was Mark's business card.
That was Mark's business card.
There was an excerpt of the book in Wired just this week.
Yeah.
You talk about programmers and the culture that of the early days of Facebook.
So, yeah, like Facebook...
frat boys, practically.
We think we know the story because we saw the movie, and it was all about what happened at Harvard. But that was only a couple months. That was just like Christmas to the spring. One semester. So in the summer of 2004, they said, I'm going to take this Facebook.com thing, and I'm going to go to Silicon Valley because I hear it's happening. That's where it's happening. And he didn't even know that. What he was copying, which was Friendster, was a company. Okay, he didn't understand that companies made things.
He was 19.
He knew nothing. And he didn't even know that everybody thought the web was over. Everybody thought 2004 that was just a fad, right? And so he goes out there, and it's just a big joke for him. But then they loved to code and they worked on it and they drank a lot of beer and it starts getting some traction. And then they meet this older and wiser 23 or 4 year old Sean Parker. That's what I was getting
from Napster.
From Napster says, like, I'm going to show you how it's done.
That's the line in the movie, which nobody ever really said, which is, you think $1 million is cool? No, $1 billion is cool.
He might have said it. I don't know.
It's a good line.
It's a great line.
I think Aaron Sorkin said it.
Aaron Sorkin said it. But I think Aaron Sorkin tapped into something.
Yeah.
Anyway, so all my quotes from those guys
are real.
Are real, by the way. There's no screenwriting in here. Mm-mm.
In fact, actually, that's one of the things, and we mentioned this last time, that's really great about this book. There's no Adam Fisher in here. This is all the work in this book was assembling quotes from 200 people.
Yeah. And splicing them together.
Putting him in order. He was on knee pads with scissors and paste, putting it all together. But then it flows, and it's like just a great cocktail party where some of the most interesting people you've ever met are just telling stories. How it happened.
And the story about the early Facebook is one of the things they were working on was this keg bot. You know this one?
No.
They had a keg, that was in the office. This is when they finally got an office and they weren't working out of a house. And on University Avenue, and you'd go to the keg, you work there, and the keg would recognize who was at the keg and tell everybody, hey, so-and-so is drinking. You know, join them, right?
And
as it turns out, this is actually maybe the start of their facial recognition patents. So they're,
that's how
it started. And if you read the account of what early Facebook was like, it was one big keg party.
Right.
People got to work at no earlier than noon. A lot of them came in their pajamas, including Ruchi, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce her last name, but she was the first female engineer there. And they would work all day till cocktail hour, go out, have some beers and a burger, come back and drink all night long as they pushed out new code.
You can Carson, if you pull up the Wired story, there's more pictures from that era. And I think, I'm not sure, but the mural behind them in that picture, as I remember, they paid for in Facebook stock.
That's right.
And that the muralist is now a multimillionaire.
Yes, that whole story
the
is
massage
there.
Massage therapist. There you go. That mural right there.
The mural is all there. The whole story about, you know, it's a graffiti thing and all the kind of pornography. Who did, you know, it was actually apparently Sean Parker's girlfriend who did the most pornographic parts of that mural, not the graffiti artist from L.A.
Wow. Ruchi Sanghvi.
Sanghvi, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you talk to so many people. I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Some of those. There you go. So that's Sean Parker on the right. Right? Am I right?
Yes, on the right.
And then in the middle, who's that? It says
D'Angelo.
Carson in the quote.
Is it
in
D'Angelo?
The caption.
Let's see. No, Dustin Moskovitz.
Moskovitz,
yeah,
that's
I didn't
right.
Didn't get to talk to him.
Yeah. And then is on the floor, is that Mark?
Yeah, it's Mark.
Yeah. You can tell from the curly hair, and that's the mural, that the $1 million mural. The massage therapist also became a millionaire because, you know, if you were smart in those days, you took stock instead of cash.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
That's where the programmer culture comes from. This whole, you know, it was a
that's
company
what started it.
Run like you would, you know, why is Facebook have this sophomore culture, right? That's the big question. Well, It was founded by sophomores, literally, and that DNA still pervades.
You quote Terry Winograd, you said, Facebook was more of a undergraduate culture. Google was more of a graduate student culture.
Right. But the parties at Google were legendary.
Oh, really?
Vanity Fair took a huge bite of this chapter because that was the kind of sexiest chapter. That was the most Vanity Fair. Like, you know, they
wanted the sex.
So they wanted the sex. So, you know, Google, as we find out, is almost literally founded at Burning Man. And then they would have these annual parties where they'd go to Tahoe with the whole company. Not everybody in the company went to Burning Man, but Marissa did. And
you talked to Marissa Meyer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I'd love to hear her stories about it. Well, you can. It's all in here.
It's all in there. And
this is the chapter I'm feeling lucky.
Yeah. So they'd have these huge parties, and there's this chef, Charlie Ayers, who's kind of like almost the Google mascot because everybody's fascinated that you could eat at Google. And they had this hippie chef who used to be the chef for the Grateful Dead, and he ended up running the parties up in Squaw Valley every year. And he had something called Charlie's Den, and where he would make these what he called ganja goo balls. And give them to everybody, and everybody would get so stoned they'd like pass out on each other.
Gosh.
And he said, you know, it looked like something out of The Hangover. And then I've got the first HR person at Google. She was Heather Cairns. She was employee number 4. She left just after the IPO. She was hired as office manager, and she left as the HR chief of Google, just dishing on Sergey Brin's sex life and all the kind of crazy stuff that she had to tamp down. And her point was, I was the old maid, a responsible person at 35, and everybody else was in their 20s, and the hormones were raging. She said it was out of control. The parties were not like wild by geek standards. The parties were wild by anybody's standards. Hot tubs. They'd go to like these prop houses and get all these crazy movie props for their parties. It was wild. It was just wild. But, you know, again, so was every other company. So was Atari. So was Activision.
Right.
So was this VPL back in the day. These were all, you know, one of the amazing things that comes out is that the guys who built Silicon Valley were having the time of their lives.
They were working hard.
They were working hard, but they were playing hard. Really hard. And the reason they were working hard is they were working on these creative projects that they really loved it and believed in it and you know, were having fun.
Yeah.
And I think that's the takeaway. People think like, oh, they're so smart. They must have this grand plan to get rich. That's not quite how it happened.
Did you get a sense that they had a grand plan of any kind?
No, there's no grand plan. I'm hoping they'll have more of a grand plan after they read this book, because they can see, like, there are some arcs.
It's almost a random walk.
It's almost a random walk. And like I said, maybe they could stop running into the same, you know, tiger trap if they had a little historical perspective. Yeah. And that's why I hope this book, you know, it's really kind of, this book is about the future in a way. Like, you know, you know, not only how we got here, but now where do we go? And I think the answer is, well, we've got to get back some of the you know, those kind of values that kind of made Silicon Valley great. And they're kind of being covered up by this money culture, and rediscover them and be re-inspired by them as we go forward. You know,
I like it. I'd love to see that.
I'd love to see it, too.
Yeah. The book is Valley of Genius, the uncensored history of Silicon Valley as told by the hackers, the founders, and the freaks who made it boom. And it is an arc. There really is an arc in this. And that's one of the things that's most interesting.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear where it started. It's great to hear where we are today. But I love the idea of maybe we can take away from this something and make it be more in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's not just, I mean, there's a lot of dishing and gossip, but ultimately it's serious in that sense. You know, history books, I didn't write a history book because I was interested in the past. I wrote it because I'm interested in the future, right? Every good history, every history worth reading is really kind of about the present. Like, what lessons can we learn from the past that we can apply to the future? And this book is no different. That was my aim, at least. You know, sometimes you read these oral histories and it's just like a bunch of random anecdotes.
Yeah.
But this one, I put, you know, the kind of work into it, a couple extra years to try to give it that arc and give it that momentum. And so people could see for themselves, you know, that vector of history.
It works. And honestly, as a reader, you feel like Adam's taking you on a journey. And it's a journey I really enjoyed. Thank you for joining us, Adam. I really appreciate it. We'll do Triangulation on Friday afternoons, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. You can tune in live, twit.tv/live, watch our live stream. If you do that, join us in the chat room. You're the third side of the triangle, my guest, me, and you. And you're very important, so your feedback, your thoughts, irc.twit.tv. Now, if you can't be here live, don't worry, because we make everything we do on demand available for download. Listen anywhere, anytime. You'll find it on the website, twit.tv/TRI. You'll also find it in your favorite podcast application. Just subscribe. That way you can download it. It'll actually automatically download if you subscribe and be there when you need it. When you need it the most, you can get some inspiration from Triangulation. You can even get your smart assistant to play the show. Just say, "Hey, smart assistant, listen to Triangulation," or "Listen to the Triangulation podcast," or sometimes if you're on an Echo, "Listen to the Triangulation podcast on TuneIn." Figure out the syntax, and then whatever you're doing, you're chopping some onions, you're making dinner, you could say, "Hey, Google thing, listen to the Triangulation podcast," and then you just think of all the fun things you learn. Thanks for joining us. Go out and get this book, Valley of Genius. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.